Oh, that's easy. So I believe we're recording now. So if anyone listening to this is a meeting at 3:30 in the afternoon UK time, 9:30 in the morning US time, DAC Architecture Working Group meeting, December the 19th. And we're going to just go into chit chat mode again because we're waiting for people to turn up.
Very quiet chit chat.
Hi, Alan.
Hello.
Yeah, I thought I heard your voice just there. Okay. Matt, would you like to take us through? I mean, just this presentation is the plan to show the two parts of it. The slides actually on the meeting from yesterday. I might take the time to copy them over to this.
Giovanna was going to talk first, and then I was going to.
I was going to ask who's the plan to talk first. So let's just hang on for a couple more minutes. So Dave, I think you have half an hour maximum, don't you?
Yeah, because we've been summoned to go and talk. In a certain manner to the computing people to try and understand what's happening about the computing section of the TP, which I don't think we can really miss. So,
I can talk to Giovanna's slides if she doesn't show up soon.
Okay. So how about let's give it about two more minutes. I will try and download them off the other meeting and upload them onto this meeting. But yes, maybe that would be the best next thing to do. So while I'm looking at everything else on the screen, please will someone shout up if Giovanna appears in the meeting. And as I say, I'm just going to try and... Oops, some slides have appeared there. So I think that was you, wasn't it, Matt, who put those slides on? I was just hoping that Giovanna...
Yes, those are my slides.
Yeah, excellent. Okay. So it does look like she may not be going to show. So Matt, maybe can you... Hi, Jim.
Hi, sorry, we just had a cooling failure in H1, so I'm running from one barrack to the other to switch off stuff.
Oh, no. Okay. So, do you want a bit more time?
No, look, because at some point I have to leave anyway, so...
Yeah. Okay, so we can start with your talk straight away if you've got the time to start.
You uploaded already the one from yesterday.
Do you want me to screen share it from here, or do you want to do it?
Yes, that would be great. But I think the one that is uploaded is the one from Matt and Ryan, right?
Yes, but yeah.
Okay, so let me upload.
I think for everyone on the line, you have to go to yesterday's meeting to get Giovanna's slides, but I'm going to screen share them now. I was practicing this earlier, so let me see if I can not mess it up this time. Screen. So there should be a talk there, and I can go into.
Yeah.
Does that look good for everyone?
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. Okay, great. So if you want to follow these through yourself, you have to go to yesterday's talk. We will upload them on today's meeting as well. So over to you then, Giovanna.
Okay, yeah. So after the presentation of a proposal of architecture that was done last Thursday, together with other people in the management board, we said that we would try to clarify a number of issues and also ask a number of questions that were partially asked last week to try to advance on the understanding on what is being proposed and on the and in order to be able to make an educated decision if it's something that we like pursuing or if it has some shortcomings that should be addressed before accepting such a system. So for those who don't remember the short history of Dune, at the Columbia workshop, there were basically three approaches to the Dune TDAC that were presented, focusing now mainly on the TPC data. One that I call early data processing in custom boards with interconnected FPGAs. This is basically a system based on the RCE technology, and you can see the link to that presentation, to the one presentation indicating this type of architecture that was presented. There is an alternative approach that is the one of late event selection in computer farms. So basically we would read out everything and would let computer farms eventually with accelerators that could be FPGAs or GPUs make the data selection. And there is another link to a couple of presentations which went into this direction. And then there is a third approach that is the one that is taken mainly by the dual phase, which is to perform a very early data compression combined with actually late data selection. So you reduce the amount of data to be transported, but you defer the data selection to computer farms. Last Thursday, as I said, a sketch of combining different ideas was presented, and it raised a number of questions that I will, to some extent, repeat today, and others I will try to answer in the next slides. So if you go to the next slide, you can see here the recap of what was presented last week. There is a link on the bottom left side of the page to the presentation that was made by Georgia. So what you can see here is what was presented with the front-end part that would do some pre-processing and would eventually send data onto two types of buffers, one being called the lossless buffer and the one that is only the extraction of the interesting data that were identified, that is called the lossy buffer. And from then on, there would be two levels of triggering, level 0 and level 1, that based on different information, first local and then global, would decide which data are scheduled for recording. So if you go to the next slide, you can see the same sketch. For my own clarity, I split front-end and back-end in a different place with respect to what was shown. It's a matter of terminology, but for me it was clearer to understand it that way. So there is a front-end TAQ, and there is a back-end based on PCs interconnected via switched networks. So the link between the front-end and the back-end TAQ is a set of 10 point-to-point links per APA, so 1,500 per module. The links going from the cold electronics to the front-end DAC at this stage are proposed to be 1 gigabit links, so we would have in the order of 15,000 per module. And this is what is sketched in the yellow box. So if you go to the next slide. Okay, here is my interpretation, which may not be complete because these are very new ideas, and I think that everybody has still to some extent their own understanding of what it is. But I will try to give an interpretation of this diagram that we may discuss further. So the idea is that we will have a simplified warm interface of the cold electronics, and that this one will send data on 1 gigabit per second links to the front-end TAQ, which the proposal is could be a set of ATCA boards inspired from the RCE technology. And the task of the front-end DAC is to reorganize the data to forward the complete data set to be temporarily buffered to the back-end DAC, to perform noise subtraction, Higgs split finding, and forwarding a stripped-down data set to be stored temporarily again on the back-end DAC, and also to form trigger primitives to be provided to the level 0 trigger system. And as I said, the front-end and back-end are connected via unidirectional point-to-point links. Should continue to the next slide. Okay, so the level zero decides which data sets shall be retained based on the information of one module, basically, or of a local set of information, and forwards its decision to the level one trigger. And then the level one trigger combines information from the different level zero triggers, so both photon detectors and TPC, external data sources such as other dune modules, accelerator signals, snooze alerts, and there is also an error coming from calibration, and eventually triggers the event building process. And the event building process is the task that prepares the data to be stored for the offline use. This is at least my interpretation. If we go to the next slide, I prepared a set of questions that that came to my mind when trying to understand a bit deeper this this diagram. And so the first slide that you will see here is mainly pertaining the trigger system. So the question is the trigger primitives, what would they contain? Would it be information by wire or already combined by APA? This is, I think, something that needs to be discussed and decided upon. Now the level zero trigger, again, the question is what is it doing exactly? Is it applying decisions based on the time sliced combination of trigger primitives? If this is true, then probably one host per module could do the job because it's not a very heavy task. The level one trigger, again, the question is what exactly is it doing? If external information indicates that there is interesting data, now what data should be taken at this point? Do we blindly take the full cryostats? What do we do? This is all to be understood. And then also what is the delay for distributing event building requests from the level one trigger for complete or stripped down data. And again, at least from my understanding, if this level one trigger is basically combining reduced amount of information on a time sliced basis, probably one host per module would be sufficient. If we continue to the next slide, there is a set of questions more retaining the more concerning the movement of data and the storage of data. So the data buffering, there are data that are stored in two data formats. One is complete and the other one is stripped. Now the question is, what is the lifetime of the data for both types? And what is the expected size of the stripped data compared to the full data set? For your recollection, the amount of data that we produce on the full data set is in the order of 1 to 1.5 terabytes a second per module. The other question is what is mentioned or called calib buffer in the diagram. That is not really clear to me what type of data it contains or where do the data come from. And then regarding event building, I have also a lot of questions. First of all, it's not clear to me what an event is. I mean, if it's triggered locally by the local level zero trigger information, I suppose that we can define region of interest and the time interval at which we want to take data corresponding to an event. But if we get external information, it's not at all clear what we are supposed to be doing. And so this is something I think that we need to understand better. The question is also how the event building protocol looks like. Are we going to get data by time interval, by complete APA, or only by wire? The granularity of the data that we want to choose is to be defined. Another question is how do the photon detector data come into the event? Should the accelerator data be part of the event stream as is indicated in the sketch, or is it just information that one will combine offline? And when the full data are stored, another question is should we also store the corresponding stripped version thereof, which may help seeding the offline analysis, or is this not relevant? So with the storage needs expectations discussed in Colombia, it seems to me that probably a couple of hosts per module are enough to perform the event building and storage for transfer to offline. The question is, if we are thinking of a larger PC farm after the front-end DAC, well, and after the place for hosting the buffer, the question is what would we be using it for? If we continue to the next slide. So this is just a sketch that I made for myself in order to try to see what I had understood and what were completely open questions to me. As I said, the front-end DAC could be implemented with something that resembles today's RC technology, so ATCA shelves rack-mounted, and the estimate for space is that we would need something like 3 racks per module. For storing the data, if you're using PCs, and we probably would end up with, again, a similar amount of space requirement of 2 to 3 racks per module for the complete storage. The level zero trigger, maybe if it's doing only what I listed, it may be a simple host, and similar for the level one trigger. If it's doing very complicated types of correlations, we may need more resources, but then we have the complication of distributing a level zero trigger system. It's not at all clear how data come from the photon detectors come into the game. It's not clear to me what the calib buffer is or is meant to be. As I said, I don't know whether it makes sense for the accelerator signals to be part of the event stream, or if they should just be signals that are used eventually by the level one trigger and also can be conditions data to be combined at a later stage. So this is basically the set of my understanding of the system as it was presented last week. And if you continue to the next slide. So to summarize, I think that a first architecture sketch was presented publicly only a few days ago. And I think it needs time for the collaborators that have not participated to preliminary discussions to really understand what is being proposed and in order to be able to propose modifications, suggest improvements, or highlight inconsistencies that we may not have have been spotted. In my opinion, still, and I know that Dave has other pressures, but still, in my opinion, rushing decisions in this phase may be more harmful than useful. So I would really take the time that it takes to set up a baseline architecture around which we can work. The proposal that was presented last week combines ideas shown during the workshop. The question is if it does so in a reasonable way, and this is something that really now that the community has to react to and to provide the right feedback on. I think that what we've seen last week is a very preliminary sketch with respect to a complete architecture proposal. The whole data flow actually needs to be worked out. Photon detectors must be included in the scheme. The entry point for the dual phase, as I understand it, could be handled at the input into the backend DAC, probably with a different type of I/O card. Nevertheless, the dual phase, as I mentioned at the very beginning, needs compute power in the backend because it doesn't do any heat finding or pre-trigger primitives on the front-end side or on the cold electronic side. Therefore, in any case, we will have to take into account that for the dual phase, a real processing farm is required on the backend side of the DAC. And this is different from what is being proposed, where actually the most of the processing for the single phase would happen in the front end DAC.
Great, that's fantastic. So maybe we want to open the discussion, but I know that Dave and Georgia have to leave fairly soon. So maybe if you two, can you, I mean, maybe if you have anything you want to talk about, then please.
Yeah, make a few comments. I mean, you know what I'm going to say. Number one, I mean, thanks for the talk. I think this is a very clear summary of what we know and what we don't know. It certainly appears there's more we don't know than we do know, but, you know, that's where we are. I think the list of questions, I think Giovanna has very nicely just summarized the mission of the architecture group for the next N weeks, right? I mean, this is exactly the sort of things which we have to now decide. I, one thing I will say is that though on the photon system, I think things are becoming clearer. And on the dual phase as well, I think how the data gets into the system, we can certainly, I mean, if you listen to Dave Cousins' talk on Monday, certainly ideas are starting to gel there. So in terms of the timescale, I mean, I don't want to rush anything. I we're not going to do this unless people buy into it. And if there are different ideas, we need to hear about them. Nonetheless, the dates for the public review documentation are not under our control. They are what they are. I think it would serve us very well in terms of our relationship with the funding agencies and so on, to get something in the TP which was credible. But I think we've said a few times now that that does not preclude, I mean, it explicitly does not preclude changing the idea between there and the TDR. And, you know, my attitude towards this is, if we have a baseline, that's fine, we write it down. But if anybody comes up with a better idea, which is clearly more technically robust, saves money, and is easier to do, we're going to do that, right? There's no dogmatism here. So it's uncomfortable, but, you know, where we are where we are. And the only alternative is to go back to the management and say, can we please delay our technical proposal? And I think that's not going to happen. So I think the critical time for thinking about all these questions is right now, because of the January workshop. I'm afraid we're going to leave with writing assignments, and if we don't have the information in our hands, it's going to be tough, right?
Right. Excellent. Yes. So just another thing to make you aware of. So there's a talk by Matt. I don't know if we want to start that while you're still in the meeting, Dave and Georgia. I'll let you call that one, whether to discuss more of what you've just said or whether you want to hear the other talk.
I mean, I'd like to hear some reactions to what I just said, to be honest. And then go ahead.
One minor point about the question about the interface to the photon detector. I mean, we're proposing this right now. I mean, we've been asked for a document which I circulated early this week, and I've sent to the photon detectors, and in that they have a single stream of data from them to us, and the DAQ is responsible for receiving that stream and then forwarding the relevant bits to the data selection system. So either we already have the answers now to how the photon system fits in, or we need to change the interface document right quick.
I mean, literally a single stream?
Well,
a single stream per SSP.
Yeah, single fiber per SSP.
Right.
But there's no a single stream as in that. Sorry, Georgia.
I thought that for the photon system, it was still to be determined if primitives would be sent separately.
Primitives may be generated, but they'll be sent down the same link.
I mean, that's the baseline, right? That's what we're documenting. So if there's some reason not to do that, then we change it. But that's the proposal.
And primitives will probably be associated with the full waveform. So you'll probably have a packet which has a header, which is the primitives plus the waveform. Anyway, sorry, I didn't want to use up much time for discussion now. It was it's just that time is short for this draft of the interface document.
Okay, so some modifications would have to be made to that diagram to show that the level zero would be formed from the same buffer where the data is sitting and where the event holder will retrieve things.
Yeah, but I don't think it changes the overall philosophy at all.
So actually, while we're on this slide, I find it hard to visualize that there would be, if we're going to have 15,000 fibers going from the WIB to the pre-processing boards, I find it hard to imagine that all of this could be accommodated in three racks.
Well, fortunately, the 12,000 fibers will be in the form of 1,200 fiber ribbons.
Still, that sounds like a lot of fibers.
Oh yes, but
it's
it does
a lot of fibers, but it does fit. That's the beauty of this, is that everything's very dense.
Okay, and with enough cooling and everything.
Yep.
Provided and monitoring.
Yep.
I mean, significantly bigger systems than this have been built for other experiments in a smaller space. If you go to Atlas, there's much bigger things in this one.
Okay. I also have a general comment. I think it should be understood that, you know, if we're talking about this example of RCE-style pre-processing boards and then Felix for backend, it should be understood that, that what we're doing is we're actually mixing two different philosophies for the DAC, as Giovanna pointed out. So I just wanted to highlight that.
Yes, we are. But I mean, is that a fundamental problem? I mean, if we take the best aspects of both architectures, I mean, to some extent, you know, these things, one of the strengths, I think, of what's on the screen is that it relies on bits and pieces which we've already got. You know, it relies upon a board which is in Prosthodune, relies upon another board which is in Prosthodune, and an event builder system which we already have, more or less. And to me, that's a strong argument. You know, you don't really have to invent any of this. It's all there already. It's not the same, but it's there's an obvious trail of development from Prosthodune to this system.
Do we actually have a pre-processing board, a lightweight one, developed?
Yeah, it's called a cob.
So no major design modifications are needed?
No, there will be some. We plan on replacing the FPGA, but other than that, not really.
But the pipeline of algorithms here, those haven't been implemented, have they?
A couple of them have. The coherent noise subtraction has not, and that's a tricky one. But I would say everything else has. Hit finding, trigger primitives are basically the same thing. Well, the same algorithm was a tweak, and we implemented that for 35 ton, but we didn't run with it. Filtering has been done lots of times in other contexts.
Algorithms exist, then does this answer Giovanna the question that Giovanna pointed out about what those look like?
What do you mean, what those look like?
So in a subsequent slide, Giovanna asked if the trigger primitives are per channel.
They certainly can be. I think that's something we have to decide, right? We can do it per channel. We can do it per time bunch. I mean, there's lots of things we can do. But I mean, the larger point is, right, we have to put all this together and show that it works. Yeah, I mean, that's just something we have to do. But the pieces most of the pieces we've done in the past, or for compression, we're implementing now for Prosthodune.
I have a fundamental question in regard to the proposed architecture, actually based on definition that Giovanna does. Now the lossless buffer sits on the back-end DAC. What does it mean? It means that at the front-end DAC, we don't need, a big buffer?
So that's correct right now, yes, that's right. With this thing, we don't need a huge RAM buffer.
Then that means a full bandwidth, you need to send everything from the front end to the back end.
Correct.
Something like, I don't know, how much it was, 80 gigabit per second from one cop out?
That's just 8, 10 gig links.
Right. And this is not Ethernet. This is going to be some point-to-point link.
Okay, it's a point-to-point link directly to the Felix then, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
I see. Then you use probably 4 quad SFP per cop to one Felix.
Two would do it. I mean, two.
I see. You compress also data then, right?
No, because we're talking 80 gigs, and you could do 80 gigs on 2 quad SFPs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. You're right.
So one.
Technically, probably going to be more than 80 gigs, though.
I mean, we'll probably put more. We'll put more than that to have options, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That was my point. Actually, there is some dinner, so it would be probably more than 2 quads a piece. So.
Yeah, okay. it might be one of these 12 fiber things.
So, kind of on that topic, one thing I don't quite understand, and I think will cause problems for us when other people review is that this is sort of a belt and suspenders model. Specifically, why if really the can handle this kind of heavy computing pipeline, why can't it also output? To Ethernet and UDP, and then the back end would just need fast network cards. I mean, why have Felix in there if the RCEs can do all of this?
Yeah, that's exactly also my question that I'm thinking to find it. Just
so why don't why so, so why don't I give. Why don't I give Ryan? Well, I'm going to give Ryan slides. Ryan, actually, why don't since you're here, you can give your slides.
Okay, thanks.
I just stole 3 slides from the talk.
I saw them.
Okay. Or I can talk. That's fine. I'll talk.
No, so one of the main things is we don't have to try to figure out some type of reliable protocol. And we have a reliable protocol, but of course, then you have to then process that in software, and of course, software's got to do, the chunk by chunk and everything. And so typically when we do RSSI from a piece of hardware to a CPU, we tend to put a custom NIC in there, and the custom NIC decodes the protocol and it converts everything back to a frame. And so, well, here we're just kind of bypassing that whole layer and just sending full frames of data over a point-to-point link that's got a very simple protocol, low overhead. It can either be GBT. We have a PGP protocol we're fairly fond of. Either one, it doesn't really matter. But you're not breaking things into small network chunks in the firmware and wasting space to do that. You're just basically pushing it out on a large frame, receiving that in the Felix, caching it up, and doing a large DMA in the memory instead of dealing with small little packets that you would on the network layer.
Yeah, I mean that sounds good to me. I mean, I'm not a hardware expert, but all of that sounds good. I think the question we have to answer though is that comes at a cost, right? I mean, Felix, I think for what it does is not expensive, but it is more expensive than buying an off the shelf, 100 gigabit per second network card. Right. So can we justify, the benefits that Felix gives us given the extra cost is really what it'll come down to, I think.
So I think that's an important question, Brett. I'm just wondering whether it'd be best to postpone that to another meeting, because both Dave and Georgia have now left, and they were main people using the hybrid architecture. I think then to sort of ask us as the architecture group, given that this seems to be a good solution from the sort of financial point of view, maybe. Can we actually do it, and what are the advantages? Maybe that's the sort of first discussion that we should have. So start off in the positive way, if you like, rather than why do we have to do this?
Yeah, I mean, on the technical side, I mean, this issue of having to break things up into packets in order to go over UDP. Is there a technical reason that doing that really makes a problem on the receiving end? I mean, if the answer is if yes, then we've got one step towards understanding.
The main point of this is just to optimize the data for the DMA and the Felix and then take it through that known layer.
Yeah. The thing to remember, Brett, is that right now what we need is a plausible scheme, not an optimal scheme. We can do the value engineering. We should do the value engineering over the next year. Right now we just have to write down something that we can show works and is affordable. And if the sums come up reasonable for this, then this is a really good start because of all the reasons people have said in terms of we've tried lots of it.
Additional to the cost of the Felix, I mean, there is another thing. I remember during the workshop in Colombia, there was a argument against a point-to-point architecture. That the argument was, if one of the point at the backend dies for whatever, so we will lose some of the part of the data. But if it is based on the, how to say, the network, TCP IP, either UDP or whatever, it would be routed automatically and quickly to another redundant machine. So there would be sort of a very low risk to losing the data. So this is one of the other things comparing to the point-to-point or the network-based data transferring to the backend. Which I think it's also as important as at the cost. Or I don't know if this argument is not anymore valid.
So, I mean, I think that's a reasonable argument. Ryan has not in the slides I included, but I mean, there we'll have redundant point-to-point links. And on the ATCA, we can easily reroute the data to go into one of those links, and then we just plug that link into the back of the, or we use a patch panel to get that fiber back into the Felix board. It's not automatic, of course. But it's not, you know, it's not new hardware.
Imagine one of the, for example, if not one of the pieces go out, I mean, one of the Felix go out, which is probably at least two QuadSFP bitrate. Could you send it all to QuadSFP bitrate through the backplane of the ATCA? I'm not sure because...
Oh, yeah, that's no problem.
Yeah, so that's basically...
Yeah, right, exactly. That's,
and probably a first level redundancy is we would just take one COB, we'd have, you know, eight links going out at eight redundant links, and those eight redundant links would go to different Felix boards. And so at that first level, we wouldn't even have to go across the backplane. We do have the option to go across the backplane if need be.
You're suggesting having twice port more in one COB and to the Felix, or is this what I understand?
Yeah, I would overwire it in terms of getting it to the Felix boards.
Yeah.
Okay, so it means that twice costing of the QuadSFP, which is not cheap, you know, each of them are a few hundred dollars plus the.
I think these are short range versions. I think we found some cheaper than that now. I'd have to ask Larry though. He keeps finding cheap fibers.
Yeah, one thing to note is that Felix is downstairs in everything we're talking about here. I mean, potentially it doesn't have to be, but Felix is basically sitting right next, is in a rack right next to the ATCA.
And we don't have to pay for the redundancy. I mean, we can leave it out.
Right. Right. But it's a possibility, right?
And this is a nice idea. And I think at this stage, just a very early observation of the architecture, it's a very good feature to point out. As I say, I mean, if it ends up costing too much, then we'll have to think a bit harder. But at this level, it's very reassuring that we've got that facility.
But I think generally, yes. I mean, Ethernet, certainly if you were in a switch, then everything is easier. But
yeah, but that will cost a lot of money as well, probably. Yeah. So, but it's very good to point out that same feature is available here by just doubling up the outputs from the RCEs. So I'm aware that Giovanna will have to leave sometime soon. She may have gone already, actually.
She is gone already. She sent a chat message.
Okay. Yeah. Well, okay. Bon vacances. But do you guys want to give your presentation, Matt and Ryan?
So we just have three slides, but it shows sort of slightly more detail what we do on the front end.
Yeah. Do you want me to display it on the screen share, or do you want to do that?
Sure, go ahead.
I'll do that. Okay, hang on. I think I just do this, and then this, and then this. Can you see this now?
Yes.
Well, yeah.
Does that look okay, or should I try and make it full screen and see what happens? I'll do this and see if it did.
That's good.
Does that look a mess now, or does that look good?
Oh, that looks fine.
That's fine.
Oh, good. Okay. So go ahead then. Show us what, tell us what this is.
Ryan, you tell us what this is.
Yeah, so I mean, so this just shows the overall data flow. We're getting data from the front ends. We're doing, you know, filtering, feature extraction, et cetera. We have the timing interface on the COBS. We show here, of course, we have, you know, if we were to load the flash memory on the DPMs, we could provide a supernova buffering here in a distributed way as a possibility. So then we go ahead and go out to, you know, the, whatever processing we want in the RCE, and then we send it directly to the Felix boards. Either GBT or PGP or whatever protocol we all agree upon there. The next one, basically, I show how we have, you know, we'd have multiple options for how we, you know, route data out. We'd have the processing RCE, we'd have an outbound RCE, they could be the same device. And then the outbound RCE is connected to the Felix, and we take advantage of the RCE interconnect to move data around. Of course, we have extra links. Felix cards, and then we can, you know, if one goes out, we can reroute, or we can adjust the load balancing if we need to. So if we find that Felix can handle more data than we're giving it, then we, you know, we adjust. If he handles less data than we're giving it, then we can adjust as well. Go on to slide 3. So I kind of threw together kind of a, you know, benefits of Felix with ATCA. The ATCA provides the front end processing. We can do the filtering, feature extraction, whatever other type of processing we need to do there. We propose that the RCE provides a supernova buffering, but that can be discussed. You know, this is the first level things that are connected to the in-cold electronics. We, you know, we're taking advantage of the reliability, the cooling, the redundancy of the system, so we can keep a high uptime. We have the ability within the RCE to reroute data. If need be, we can route around failed uplink fibers or a bad Felix node. The Felix provides a point-to-point path between the ATCA, RCEs, and the backend data processing. You know, we don't have to worry about network congestion, flow control, et cetera. It's all point-to-point link. We know the bandwidth we have available to us. We don't have to do a protocol on top of it, deal with the switch network. We don't have to try to manage the switches to, you know, kind of form the data so that we don't have congestion points. We're just dealing with point-to-point links here. Everything stays in their native size. We don't have to chunk them up into small transfers to send over the network. And then we basically have, you know, a better idea of the data integrity. We can, you know, CRC an entire frame, send it over, the retries and everything aren't a problem. We just is the whole event damaged or not. And the backend processing follows the classic Felix architecture. We're on a known system at that point, and then they take advantage of the back-end system that's provided there.
So for this this buffering, the RCE just takes regular, you know, like DDR RAM DIMMs?
So are you talking about the supernova buffering?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're going to design the DPMs, and so they'll have a connector on them that we can put flash memory on. And so then if we don't need it, we don't load it, doesn't add cost. If we do put it on there, we do. It can take the bandwidth of the data coming in through one DPM, and that provides that. So we're not going to write to this buffer all the time. We're only going to write to this once we've decided we want to keep the data. We still take advantage of the memory that's on the RCE to kind of have this pre-trigger buffering. For the supernova, the same way we had proposed in earlier presentations.
I see. So this is not it's not constant throughput. It's just a
no. I mean, we'd burn, I think we calculated 80 hours we'd burn through the flash memory if we were to do that.
Yeah.
Okay. I think having a distribute, if the requirement is a lossless supernova, you know, when we self-trigger on a supernova, if we need the lossless for X seconds, I think you pointed out that you sort of need a distributed system of drives.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess what that means, though, is that I'm trying to pull up the this hybrid design again, but there's no, okay, let me finish my sentence. To work in that mode, the RCEs need to get notification of at least module level.
That's right.
Yeah. So the trigger has to work its way back to the front end in that case.
So And that we get the time. So, okay, well, that's correct. And so, you know, if we use like a proto-doing timing system where triggers are sent over the timing stream, then, you know, we get the timing stream. So that works. If it's another stream, it would just Ethernet. I mean, we'll have connections to the Ethernet too. So we can be on we can get those things. But you're right, exactly. We would need to know whether there's a supernova trigger.
And there's a latency.
There's definitely some latency. Hopefully less than a second.
Yeah, so but this is a fine thing to keep in the drawings for the one until we answer those questions.
Yeah. I mean, there's other ways you could do this too. You could have this distributed buffer on a set of PCs. But here it's sort of, I feel like having it closer is a little easier.
I think in any architecture, you're never going to be able to, I can't imagine any architecture where we're going to be able to stream everything directly into the flash memory constantly. So you're still going to have some pre-stage buffer in memory.
Yeah.
I think we figured we had tens of seconds of buffering.
If we put in 32, I think it's about 10 seconds, 32 per RCE.
Yeah.
It's about 10 seconds.
One question regard to the, since now I think it's clear that we're going to have 81.2 gig link to the RTM. Is there any change now to the VPM, I mean the fourth generation one now, because I don't remember any DPM gets 20 a link from the RTM right now?
So I think what we're going to end up with is we'll end up with a DPM that'll bring the input RTM lines into select IOs instead of to the high speed transceivers.
I see. So this one that we have the schematic needs to be changed now.
Yes, that we would need to change that. Now there's advantages to that. If there's a non-standard protocol on that, it's easier to do with select IOs than it is with the standard transceivers. So at these rates, it makes more sense to do that.
Okay, so basically there would be 21.2 gig coming to the DPM, and there would be how many 10 gig goes out?
Yeah, the remainder would be 10 gigs. Right now we have wiring on the COB for 24 links to each DPM.
Okay, the switch that is in the COB already, is it 4 gig switch? Yes, 40 gig switch, right?
Yes, it is. It's got, yes, it has a 40, it will be a 40 gig when we get the LSST version done.
Then how many, I mean, how much traffic it can handle? I mean, one 40 gig or four 40 gig? I don't remember the specification of the chip.
It's, we can do 240 gig links per DPM is what's currently routed on the board.
One last question.
That's not really what we're proposing, right?
We're not proposing that, but that is what's wired on the COB.
Yeah, right.
One other question regard to the RTM, dropping the I know that the current solution is NTP connector transceivers. Receivers over there. Is that right?
This is for what? This is the timing distribution?
No. NTP connector.
We have to decide what we want to do for that connection. Yeah, it's whatever we need to support on the RTM. I know that's been discussed.
Yeah, I mean, as long as they fit, right?
I think
we can support whatever as long as it fits. And so far, what we've been discussing does seem to fit.
So I mean, this is actually great, because I think the summary of these slides is that you folk can basically integrate the RCE system in with a Felix downstream of it by basically sending out the data on GBT or PGP rather than doing it on Ethernet packets. Is that a useful summary, do you think?
Pretty much, yes.
That you haven't sort of identified any showstoppers in the proposal that Dave and Georgia have sort of, you know, showed us last week. Okay.
No.
And so I think what you're saying is that you're advocating that this could be done by having the supernova buffer and everything on the RCE, but it's also possible to do it by pushing all the data on through the Felix and then do it dual phase style at that point, which is where it becomes a hybrid.
We should maybe try to train ourselves not to use the word buffer, but maybe like supernova dump or something.
Yeah, you're right. That's a better term.
Just so that we don't forget that it's not a throughput, it's not a through going, it's just a...
Yeah. And one complication is that, right, while you're doing this, while you're doing the dump, you also have to be receiving data and processing data all the time. So that can be tricky. And so we need to be careful.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, we should look at that, but I would guess, well, during a dump, as long as it continued to dump for as long as we needed it to, given some guidance from supernova theory, you know, then if there's any kind of beam activity during that time period, we could just deal with it offline. But I don't know, that's just off the cuffs, maybe.
Yeah, potentially, yeah.
Matt, if I'm not mistaken, you said that you're going to send the full, there is a bandwidth of sending the full online throughput of the API that you get to the backend. So if that's true, then why you want to dump the supernova, why we want to dump the supernova locally at the ATC? Just send them all back.
The proposal is we think that we can handle it in a distributed fashion and not have, you know, you can do the bandwidths that are, the bandwidth you're pushing through each individual RCE versus getting it into a PC, then you have to, a lot larger bandwidth you have to deal with at that point.
Right. Felix is taking a really large amount of data into its RAM buffer. And then if a supernova comes, it has to shunt that data into a distributed set of flash memory or something, right? Drives.
Yeah, I mean, I this was a concern I've had for a little bit too, that you know, you look at what's available for fast, you know, permanent storage, and the fastest I can find are these Intel NVMe SSDs, which are like 2.5 gigabytes per second. And I couldn't find anybody who had, you know, managed to write to four of those in parallel to get 10 gigabytes per second. That's
10 gigabit. Well, no, it's 10 gigabytes per second.
10 gigabyte. Right. I mean, we need 10 gigabytes, and so we need four of those, Intel guys, in principle, if not more.
Right.
I hadn't found someone who'd actually tried that. Probably it would work, but it would be some R&D.
Giovanna's talking about having four Felix, or, you know, taking four APAs per Felix PC, if you will.
Four APAs per Felix PC. Now I'm scared again.
Right. So I think if we take that route, we would have to split that up. Well, probably.
Yeah, so I think there's a real technical, good technical reason for wanting to dump in a distributed manner. I mean, we'd have to distribute anyways, and so if we can do it when it's already, you know, in chunks, it seems like an elegant way to do it.
Brett, there are some motherboards that they have multiple PCI bus and controllers that they are independently. You can transfer data between RAM and CPU, different part of the CPU and RAM and so on. I'm not sure, Joanna, they are proposing to use them, but just I wanted to let you know that there are some of them, especially they are using it for the GPUs, which it multiply the state of it between RAM, CPU, and the PCI and other peripheral stuff. I have dropped one of them in one of my talks. If you want, I can send you the link to that sort of server motherboards.
Yeah, sure. But I'm a little confused. This allows for like writing to SSD at 10 gigabytes per second?
If you put your SSD as a SSD PC, mini PCIe or PCIe SSD card in one of the PCIe lane and put it at the other one, which that PCIe lane is separate and has a different separate controller from the first one, and go on, then the data rate and data, data flow are independent. So you have, for example, if you have two PCIe separate by, so it would be double up.
Would that drive the cost of a PC too high though? I mean, would that server be something special that would drive the cost higher? Or?
No. It's the one that I have seen is something like between, the bare body is something like $2,000.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we need demonstration that it works. Of course. But okay.
I cannot tell you 100% it works, but because I never worked with it, these things are new, so I just saw people they are talking about it, and it seems they are using it. So.
Okay. So we actually have another presentation possible this afternoon. So from Brett, and I think we should do it this afternoon.
Are you sure you don't want to? Well, if Brett is able to do it, put Brett's hardware-oriented talk in the hardware meeting on Thursday.
We could do. I just didn't want to sort of leave talk sort of that people are prepared until after Christmas, because I think that's just unfair on the people who prepared them to make them wait that long. That's all.
Would you be able to talk on Thursday, Brett?
Yeah, whatever works best for people. It's not a huge thing. It's just maybe some showing that we're okay with 10 gigabytes per second into one computer. Maybe 4 times that, I would start to get worried again. But one,
yeah.
So we can wait. That's fine. Whatever people want.
Should we do that, Giles? Given that we've run for an hour.
I mean, we have run for an hour. Yeah, I don't want to bore people either. Too long a meeting all in one go. I just want to ask you with the hardware group. I mean, I thought the hardware was basically the sort of, you know, stuff that we make ourselves type of hardware, and that writing stuff into and out of memory was more of a software thing. But I don't know. I really don't mind as long as Brett gets to give his talk and it's not ignored. That's the only thing.
I'd always interpreted it as sort of hardware implementation.
Well, I mean,
so sort of including GPUs and stuff.
I could just give it now. I mean, it's not that long.
It's up to you. I have to go in about 5 minutes, but it's up to you and Giles.
Yeah, I mean, it's not so much about hardware per se, other than I do some testing on 4 different hosts that I have, generic PCs.
Let's go for it now, if you like.
Okay. Bye then.
So I'll just so I don't have to advertise later. So I've also put a third thing on the Indico page, which is an advert for a note that we've written in Oxford. I mean, I've done most of it. I have to take the blame for that. I mean, it's some interesting reading for people over the Christmas break. It's some things that we were thinking about over the summer. And now that this general architecture has appeared, it was actually quite easy to summarize it in the context of that. So I had a go at that over the weekend, and it seemed to work. So there's quite a lot of detail and information in there. And well, information is probably too strong a word. It might be rubbish, but it's certainly something interesting that you may want to read. And we can have a presentation early next year if it hasn't been shown to be rubbish. So Brett, if you'd like to go now, that's absolutely great from my point of view.
Okay. Either you need to stop sharing or you can share my slides.
Thank you for reminding me. So I'll, maybe I'll let you put your slide up if that's okay, because then you're in control. It's quick for you to do that.
Okay, let's see. All right, you see it okay?
Yeah, it's good.
Okay, so yeah, so this has just been some stuff I've been kind of working on in my spare time. I've been, you know, just wanting to demonstrate that that we can actually handle a full rate ring buffer using just sort of off the shelf computer parts. The basic issue, I mean, this is very simple. We have to have multiple threads involved, one pushing data into the ring. Where it gets that data is still yet to have more testing. But assuming that you've got, you know, a vector of ticks from a bunch of channels in local memory, you know, you then push it to a ring, that ring fills up and gets drained by another thread that pops stuff off. So for me, this was kind of new. This sort of threading was new for me, and so I wanted to learn a bit and also use that as an excuse to sort of demonstrate what we can do. So how do I code it? Can it keep up? And how does the actual choice of hardware matter? And then a second, not quite conclusive test was, I was then worried about getting data actually into the input of this push. So I have some tests, which I'll just go briefly. It's probably not very applicable, but looking at how fast I can get data from the operating system. So I went through a bit of learning how to do proper multi-threading, and I was looking at, you know, how to do things with standard C++, using standard thread, what Boost provided and what TBB provided. So I started out, I guess, as most do, using a mutex to protect the memory in between pushes and pops. That turns out to be actually rather slow. I then learned about this using standard atomic to handle what's called lockless protection for the indices that mark the head and tail of the ring buffer. Now this, I realize, it requires monotonically increasing indices forever and ever, which has some implications I'll show down here. But by going to this so-called lockless mode, gets a huge amount of throughput to factor of 10. Actually, it was even a little better in some tests. And then I learned that actually to do the ring buffer, of course, you've got a way to loop around the ring, and the naive way is to use a modulo, you know, the percent operator. And that's actually turns out to be quite slow. And if one chooses a ring buffer, which is a perfect factor of 2, then that modulo can be replaced by just a simple bit mask. And that gave me another factor of 2 throughput. And then there's a little bit of speed increase depending on the size of the index into the ring array. 32 bits are a little bit faster than 64, but then that has a problem that we would overflow 32 bits in about 35 minutes. So we'd have to have very short DAC runs if we wanted to use that. It's not really worth it. So using the full 64 bits, you know, we can basically run the DAC forever and we'll never overflow. And then there's a bunch of details about, you know, how to allocate the ring, and not surprisingly, it's much faster just to allocate one gigantic chunk all at once, and then do some internal management of that big block of data. So the test code I have in GitHub, you can, if you want to play with it yourself, there's a little fabric file that will deploy it. You know, do the git checkout, do the compilation, run the test programs, clean up, and then save a little log file for each host. So the host I had, I just took what was available, just easily, you know, that I have. So there's four of them, all different, all Intel, but all different, you know, generations. HAL is my ThinkPad laptop. It's quite old. But actually performs and sometimes better in my workstation, which is quite new. I also have the i7 workstation. This Heracles has a huge number of cores, but they're all quite slow. It has fast DDR RAM, but still, because of the slow cores, doesn't perform quite well. And then the best performing one we have is actually what we're using for the Cold Electronics lab, which is DDR4 and also a fast i7. So here just summarizes all of that. In particular, the numbers in parentheses are the max DDR speeds that I just grabbed from Wikipedia. So although in principle all of these computers have memory which is fast enough, you know, they don't all perform enough to get 10 gigabytes per second throughput. So I have a couple of tests just to summarize. One is just simply shoving integers through a ring buffer just so I can learn how to write the ring buffer. And it's this where I get that factor of 10 and then 2 improvement by going from standard mutex to using the atomic plus modulo and then atomic plus bit mask. And then I have another initial just toy where I have the full ring buffer that's got some number of channels wide and some number of ticks deep. I picked 4,000 ISX channels just for convenience. This is bigger than we would actually, you know, use. So this test corresponds to sending a little over 800 gigabytes through the ring buffer. But in fact, there's actually a memcopy that happens both at the input and the output. So as far as RAM sees, it's actually two times that transfer. Okay, so here's a summary. Whoops. The first three columns just show the integer results, and basically you can see the factor of about 20 increase by going to those different optimization techniques. And then the last is the real test, which shows pushing data through. The second to last column, you can see the throughput for these four hosts. And you see that with this 4 gigahertz i7 with DDR4, you know, we get comfortably above 10 gigabytes per second. Although I'm a little confused why it does so well, because it's actually close to the theoretical max. And given that there's actually two RAM transfers for each tick, I'm not quite understanding why it does so well. So that's weird.
Why should the CPU be the bottleneck rather than the bandwidth anyway?
Well, I don't know exactly why, but it is.
Brett, my guess is you're getting artificial caching on this memory.
Okay.
A lot of this is really going through the cache.
Okay, so you think that the cache sizes are actually what's more critical than the CPU speed?
Yeah, well, I mean that has to do with the duty factor of how things go through. When you push things in, when you pull things out, you know, it's been my experience when I do tests like this, you have to be really careful that you don't get fooled by artificial caching boosts. I'm not saying that's what's happening here, but it's been my experience that that's kind of what happens. And this process should be totally dominated by the memory bandwidth.
Okay. Well, the cache sizes certainly are ordered in the same order as the throughput here. So, I mean, as you go down this table, the hardware has bigger cache. Okay. So yeah. So that maybe is something that needs better checking. But I think that the conclusion is that at least for RAM to RAM ring buffer transfer, that we're okay. That I can believe that we can do 10 gigabyte per second if we can get the data into RAM in the first place.
But then what do you do with the data after you've got it? I mean, you're going to have to paw through this and do some analysis. So that's yet another touching of the data.
Absolutely. So this includes, again, the memcopy going in and out. But what you do with that pop is yet to be tested. Absolutely, yeah. And that's still a, you know.
And how are you feeding this memory?
For this test, I have basically one array of 4096 shorts, which is just
copied in
on the heap once, and I just copy that memory each time into the ring.
And in a real situation, where would that source be? Ethernet, Felix?
That depends on the design.
It's certainly Ethernet, there's at least three or four copies in most Ethernet stacks.
Right. I was reading a bit about that yesterday, and I found some talk from Fermilab, actually, that kind of went through all of that.
Yeah, it'd be good to find somebody who knows a little bit more about that. But I've worked with a bunch of stacks, and it really depends on how they've implemented, how many copies go through in TCP/IP.
Yeah, so how the memory gets in is a big issue. I've just started asking the Felix experts for some pointers, and I've got a bunch of information to go through now. It talks about how the Felix driver, does a DMA into system RAM. And so I'm now interested to understand, if that's used, how the DMA input works when you're using kind of more normal non-driver code to read the output of that ring buffer, if that makes sense. That's still a big concern.
So I missed somewhere what the requirement was and where the requirement came from. So 10, you said 10 gigabytes a second is good.
Oh, well, 10 gigabytes per second is just what the APA, what one APA produces if it's using 16 bits per sample. It's okay. At 12 bits, it's 8 gigabytes per second. So this is just the benchmark I picked, that if we are going to shove one APA's data into a single box, into a single computer.
I got it.
This is what has to happen. It has to build to do that. So now how this particular computer might fit into the design, I think is...
Right. JJ's question, though, then is, you have to do more than this, obviously, and so...
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So one of the issues is that, when a trigger comes in and says, save this chunk of data between this timestamp and this timestamp, something has to go into that live ring buffer, find that data in a way that doesn't violate, threading. And copy that data out and do something with it.
Right. So this is the issue that got raised yesterday, which had me confused at least a little bit. So there's two buffers. There's the ring buffer, what we've been calling the ring buffer, which is lossless and looks like this 10 gigabytes a second. And then there's this lossy buffer, which presumably is a zero suppressed or otherwise compressed buffer. And the question is, where is our primary data stream coming from? If the primary data stream is coming from the ring buffer, then there is additional processing for some types of triggers that has to happen. We may decide for a supernova burst, if it's rare enough, we keep everything. So I think understanding exactly how much has to happen on this data set and when will be helpful. I'm guessing, given what you just said, this is all doable, but we should make sure we have the exact sort of data flow numbers everywhere.
Yeah, that's right. And that's really a question for this so-called baseline data flow diagram. It's how we might use this buffer will depend on really that diagram. In my mind, I had said, since we started this, that I wanted to look at the possibility of having this be the input now to doing event selection in commodity CPU, which is a different design than what's in the baseline data flow diagram. And that's fine by me, but I'm not beholden to anything at this point. But so how this gets used depends very much on our design.
I still think, even if it's not the baseline, as a proponent for the baseline, I still think this is really interesting, and this is the sort of stuff we need to understand.
Yeah, so. I mean, it, it, if we keep the box that shows, you know, Felix and lossless buffer, then this would clearly be a component of that box.
Yeah, and it's also a box in the dual phase, the way they're planning to send us the data as well. So,
yeah, exactly.
I think these studies are really, really valuable because they'll allow us to spot a bottleneck, and also if someone's proposing some enormous amount of processing can be done in a tiny CPU farm, that this will show whether that's true or not. At least it'll show one part of that.
If I can just chime in, 4 gigahertz CPUs are much more expensive than 2.2 gigahertz CPUs, so it will very much affect the cost estimates too.
Yeah, I actually, that's another good point. So Brett, maybe another test that could be done would be to run several of the cores at the same time, to each demanding sort of pushing and pulling data out from the memory, as to whether that makes it go slower or not, because that may address what Glenn just said, which is that if you can get four sort of less fancy cores working rather than one big fancy one.
Well, this is running on two cores, right? There's one core is very busy pushing and one core is very busy popping.
Right.
But on
the CPUs that we've got at the ProtoDune, which you're welcome to use, by the way, as a test for this, they're Xeons. I think they've got eight cores in each. I think there are eight cores in each of the two processors.
And what's the clock speed?
I don't remember. It's not super duper high. It's two point something, I think.
Yeah. So this Hierocles workstation here at BNL, that sounds like, although there's more cores, it's 2.2 gigahertz. You know, it doesn't perform.
Yeah. It doesn't perform as well as the.
Yeah. But it, yeah.
So it's the top line on that graph, which is the
3.6. Yeah.
3.6. Yeah.
Right. So when we get to the point of looking at costs, that will be a pretty big importance thing to look at.
Because another thing with the CPUs we've got on ProtoDune, the two processors on there, and I believe that means that they have two separate PCIe buses and two separate sets of memory. So it depends whether you're writing into the memory on the other processor or on the one that you're next to.
Well, I certainly could expand this test quite easily to fill up all cores, just to see if anything degrades.
I think that would be very interesting to sort of see what happens with the numbers.
Charles, I'm guessing that's not going to make a big difference. And this thing is completely—it's got to be memory bandwidth limited. Having more cores going after the same memory is just going to bottleneck at the controller. You'll kill some of the overhead in there, but I can't believe that's going to help that much.
It would be a good test to make sure your atomic is actually protecting you, though.
That would be fine. Yeah, test that. The other thing, Brett, is that the ring buffers assume first in, first out, and that means you're believing that all your triggers are perfectly time ordered.
Well, these aren't triggers, right? This is the full.
But somebody's got to go in and fish. Somebody's got to go in and fish out the data.
Right. Right. So.
And once then you've got to pre all the way up to the place where you fished it out and throw that data away.
So my thinking on this is not complete yet, but something has to manage the readers of this data so that the thing that's popping the data off the ring knows when it's okay to do so. How that's done, I have some ideas, but I don't have.
I mean, without. I've done this sort of thing a lot of times, and yeah, ring buffers are really nice. When you start multi-threading, I think there are ways you could avoid the copy on the other one and just use the data as in the ring buffer. Then you've got to have a somewhat more complicated memory system, but there may be ways of not doing the copy on the output side.
Oh, absolutely. So I kind of glossed over that, I think, but the way this buffer works is that it, when you do a push, buffer actually delivers the pusher a pointer of memory to use. And so once the data is in the ring buffer, that data can be used, you know, directly and not have yet another copy.
Yeah, but then once you start having multiple threads go at it, those threads will complete at different rates.
Right.
The freeing on ring buffers gets a little esoteric.
Right, and so that's why there needs to be some kind of logic that is governed by the pop process, the pop thread, so that, you know, there has to be some kind of thing where worker threads can say, I'm using this tick, you know, don't make it go away until I tell you it's okay to go away.
Yeah. Not only can you got to go away, you got to make sure that nobody before you goes away, so that you have to free an order.
Yeah. So it's a non-trivial process to
yes.
pop stuff off. Yeah.
And it definitely demands that you have. How big do you believe this ring buffer is?
Well, so I've been, let's see, I have the number. It's you know, roughly 10 seconds worth of data. So it's 10 to the 8 ticks. Sorry, that's what's going through. 2 to the 18 ticks deep by 4,096 channels. So that's a little over 800 gigabyte total. 800 gigabyte in. So you have to work that out yourself, but it's the full size was, well, 2 to the 18 times 4,096 times 2 bytes. Okay, unless there's more on this part. Then I started to worry about, okay, so the RAM to RAM looks okay. But I don't have a Felix card handy or a really fast network card or anything to test hardware to RAM. So I don't really have at this point a way for me personally to test it. I have just this morning I learned about some tests with Felix, which make me not so worried. But to try to do something, I just used copying through a Unix socket, Unix domain socket, just to kind of see some test. Although I agree this is probably a total bullshit test. It's not really applicable. But anyways, I tried it. It was easy to do. So I just used SOCAT to copy dev0 through a Unix socket. And then copy the output to dev null. And I did it with just a couple of different sizes, something that might be close to what comes out of one WIB and something that might be close to that comes out of one tick across the whole APA. And the results are not great, but again, this probably doesn't even apply, so I don't want to, you know, maybe waste people's time. But the upshot is that I was able to get about half the required throughput through the domain socket. So it made me nervous, but again, it's probably not even applicable. I don't know if people have any comments on that, but okay. So the summary, I think the summary is that the ring buffer part is okay. There had to be some care not to use mutexes, but to use this so-called lockless technique. This simple domain socket FIFO test didn't achieve the throughput, but again, it may not matter because that's not really what we're doing. Felix will be tested as part of Protodune, of course. And so I suggest that we spend some time using that setup to do sustained, you know, full rate tests and just to show that we can get all that data into memory in a steady state manner. Just this morning, I found this linked proceedings where, in fact, this test has already been done, so maybe it's really nothing to worry about. But there, it did demonstrate that from Felix FPGA can DMA at 10 gigabytes per second. So I'm a little bit less concerned. Now, again, putting four Felixes in one computer, that maybe a stretch. We have to show that, but one I think is probably doable. And I got a bunch of pointers on that DMA process. So they actually, in the Atlas test, DMA directly into a ring buffer. So I'd like to understand sort of how that works at the implementation level, and then maybe expand this testing. Okay, so that's sort of my little check I've been working on.
That's brilliant. Thanks very much, Brett. Any questions? Okay, no, I think we've been talking as we've been going through a bit. So thanks very much. That's really useful. And I'm going to stare at those numbers a bit more, I think, offline and think about them a bit more. We'll have to find a way of trying to make sure that the cache is not doing something that makes it look better than it really is, though.
Yeah. I'm pretty ignorant about caching issues. I'd like to understand that more.
So I think we can look online at those processors and find out how big the caches are in them. And then thinking about just staring at your code and just looking to see that as long as the buffer is longer than that, it should have to push the stuff out of the cache to put more stuff in. But we'll have to just, yeah. I don't know, JJ could comment a bit more whether that's enough. Okay, JJ might be thinking about something else.
I couldn't find my mouse to unmute.
Oh, okay. Yes, the usual mute. Yeah, I've had that.
I mean, it really depends. It's not how deep how big the cache buffer is. It's how deep you go into it. So you got to kind of preload it so your read is well behind the write by the cache size. If you're just pushing it happy.
Oh, I see. Uh huh.
Yeah.
You could just be using, you know, just following it around and just. And just pushing it into a cache buffer, pulling it out of a cache buffer. So you got a whole bunch in and then delay it so that the other guy is no longer cache.
Okay, so if I kept statistics on like the average
I mean if you really want to go whole hog on this, there are performance monitors in the Intel architecture that tell you how many cache hits you got, how many you're missing.
Okay.
I will admit I've tried to use that and many times. Sometimes I think I understand it, and other times I don't.
Yeah. These are available under Linux?
Yeah, they're available under Linux. The problem is that Linux will swap out underneath you, and it's not real clear what the statistics mean.
Okay.
But it sounds like that you should at least delay the read pointer to be at least a certain.
Yeah, that's probably the easiest thing to do. And I've used those just as kind of a figure of merit to see if it's reacting correctly to my my machinations to try to get it out of cache.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. I could see how if it's just writing right behind the push pointer that it's just always in cache. Yeah. Okay, good. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. So any other questions for Brett? I think that's it. So I think it's been an excellent meeting. So I'll apologize for people who discovered in their email today that we actually moved the meeting time early. So how many of you missed the beginning of the meeting and would like us to just do a bit of a recap of the because unfortunately, some of the people who were presenting at the beginning have had to leave, which is why we brought the whole thing forward.
I must have had the wrong time, but that's my fault. So don't worry about me.
Okay.
I joined when Brent was talking. I thought that was the start. Sorry, I must have got it wrong.
Okay. No, I mean So the meeting should have started half an hour ago, but we started it an hour and a half ago. Because after sending out the note for the meeting, I got an inbox full of messages, all of which were divergent on each other over, well, I can't come at this time, I can't come at this other time. And then we discovered that Giovanna, who was giving the talk, was actually going to leave for holiday half an hour ago. So that's why we were basically forced to move it earlier. Otherwise, her talk would have been after Christmas. Okay. So it was a convolution of that, and also that I think our leaders had to go to a different meeting that they'd been asked to go to. I think it was about an interface with the offline. So they were apologetic as well. But if anyone else wants, so we have recorded this meeting and are still doing that at the moment. So if anyone hears this far into the meeting on the recording, well done for keeping up that long. But if you like, we can do a quick recap if anyone wants to know quickly now what it was we were talking about. No, okay. I think that's probably wise. So have a good holiday, everyone. Basically, I think we'll take up these architecture meetings probably in the new year again.
Thanks, Charles.
Okay.
Bye.
Great. Bye, everyone.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye.